Lucy, thank you so much. You've got much nicer voice than I have. And just to continue putting off the inevitable, i.e. me speaking, if you were here on Easter Sunday morning, I do apologise because you will be seeing this twice. But kind of it just so seemed to fit what I've been asked to talk about tonight. We're going to have the drama on video that we had then. So, Claire, can we have that now? Is that okay?
Grace is God's unmerited favour for us, his crazy love. And the truth is, many times we struggle understanding it. If you find yourself struggling to understand God's grace, don't beat yourself up. Even the disciples struggled with understanding grace.
Jesus, is that you? You're alive. I can't believe you're alive. Okay, I was in the boat and I wasn't catching any fish, okay? But I heard this voice and the voice said, cast your net to the other side. And so I'm thinking, I'm a fisherman. I know what I'm doing, but I'm not catching any fish, you know? And so I throw that net over there and then a gaggle of fish pop into that net and I'm going, this is a total miracle. Who could have done that? I need to know who told me to throw the net to the other side. And boom, I look up and I mean, there is you. You're looking at me on the seashore going, it is I, the Lord, and you're alive. I can't believe you're alive. This is awesome. Andrew, get out of the boat. Come on.
Peter.
Yeah.
Do you love me?
Yes, I love you. I love you. You're alive. This is so great.
Good. Then feed my sheep.
Andrew, get out of the boat. Come on, man. It's him.
Peter.
Yeah.
Do you love me?
I love you. Yes. And I'm so sorry about that rooster clucking. I had no idea what that meant, but I do not. I'm better for it. All right. Okay.
Then feed my sheep.
Andrew, I'm smiling, but I'm serious. Come on, get out of the boat. It's him.
Peter.
Yeah.
Do you love me?
Jesus, mere words cannot describe the passion that I have for you. I love you. You know everything. I love you.
Good. Good. Then feed my sheep.
I didn't even know you had livestock. That is so like you, though. There's something new about you all the time. That's what I love about you.
Peter.
Yeah.
Do you remember the morning the ladies went to the tomb?
Yeah. We're all in the upper room trying to figure out what to do next, you know, because we thought you were dead. You know, you were dead, you know, and we're trying to figure all that out, you know. And Mary comes running up, and Mary's like saying, beehive, beehive, beehive. And I'm thinking, I'm allergic to bees. Like, keep them out. You know what I'm saying? But as she kept getting closer, I heard her correctly. She was saying, he's alive, he's alive, he's alive. And we're going, who's alive, who's alive? And she said, she was at the tomb, and the tomb was empty. And she said that there was an angel there. And the angel said, go tell the disciples and Peter that everything is okay, he is risen. And so me and John, we hightailed it down there. And if John says he beat me, he's totally lying, all right? I beat him, FYI, all right, you know? And we get down there, and I'm looking in that tomb, and it is empty. There's nothing in there, you know what I'm saying? And I'm like, what does this mean? What does this mean? And John is right there. John is so good with words. He should write a book. He is so good with words. And John said, don't you get it, Peter? This is everything Jesus said he was going to do, and you did it, and it's done. Let's go. This is so great.
Wait, yeah. The angel said what?
Go tell the disciples and Peter that everything is okay. He is risen. You've risen. Let's go. This
he
is.
He said what?
Go tell the disciples and Peter. Go tell the disciples and Peter. You said my name. Why did you say my name?
Peter, that's grace.
No, I don't deserve that, because that night people kept coming up to me asking me if I belonged to you, if I was with you, and I kept denying you left and right, all right? No, it'll take me my whole life to make up for what I did. It was unforgivable for what I did.
No. What I did on the cross was meant to take what is unforgivable and make it forgivable. That's my grace. It's not about you. It's always about me. That's grace, Peter. Grace is God's unmerited.
Sorry, you've only got to have it once. Well, I thought people would laugh more second time round. Did you not like the humour? I thought I quite liked the humour. No, okay. It was kind of conspicuous silence. I thought there's no kind of little titters coming from kind of the back. You know, it was kind of something. Oh, never mind. Obviously, I just kind of like kind of odd humour. Clearly, that's what the thing must be all about. I don't know. It's good to have that, because it kind of feeds straight into the passage that John's given me tonight, which is that passage that Katie read for us, and the theme, which is all about Peter and about kind of God's strength in our weakness is about jars of clay. But it's also good to kind of keep that connection with Easter Day. Probably the boat's going to disappear after this Sunday, but it's just kind of another touchstone that takes us back to our Easter celebrations here at St. Matthew's. And I hope reminds us to keep our eyes on our broken world. It seems to me that sometimes there's a danger that as Christians we kind of create this cozy cocoon, and that kind of our faith can almost become a way of avoiding reality. And actually we live at deeply disturbing times and we can't ignore the things that are happening in the world around us. And we can't afford spiritual escapism. So it's just kind of good as we kind of think about the events of that first Easter, to do it in the context of the world in which we live today with all of its horrible reality. And I love the way that the video focuses us back as well on Easter Day, but also on Peter and his encounter with Jesus. And for me, this is a special passage. It's the one that God used to call Carol and I to ministry. So kind of it always kind of resonates, and it's always a privilege to be able to talk about it. I just want to set it in context, really. There are two contexts that I want to talk about. The first context is of the is kind of the resurrection accounts, kind of where this fits into the narrative. And the second context is kind of where this fits in with Peter's or Jesus's dealings with Peter. And so kind of if you think about the kind of resurrection occurrences, it begins on the day of the resurrection. And the first to see Jesus was a woman, was Mary Magdalene. It kind of turns everything up on its head, because kind of in that society, women kind of were not kind of regarded as being credible witnesses. Their testimony wouldn't stand up in court. Kind of it gives it a ring of authenticity. And then there are the two disciples on the Emmaus Road. And even before they can get back to Jerusalem, kind of Jesus has done this kind of strange thing where one minute he's in Emmaus with them, and the next minute before they get back to Jerusalem, he's appeared in the upper room. And I was talking about this at 8 o'clock. There is something of a mystery about the nature of the resurrection body of Jesus and of those resurrection accounts. Because, yeah, the reality of the resurrection is really clear, but actually kind of what his body was like is far from clear. You know, you have Mary in the garden who Jesus says, don't hold me because I've got to go back to my Father in heaven. And I don't think that's just hang on to. It's just like, you can't hold me now. He appears in an upper room having kind of seemingly walked through walls, which kind of suggests that his body isn't like what it was before. Yet he can sit and break bread at a table in Emmaus, or as we heard about in this reading, eat fish beside a lake, and kind of do all the physical and natural things that we would do. He can say to Thomas, put your finger in the wounds. And there's that incredible thing as well, that he's Jesus, he's alive, but the wounds are still there. And they're still there now, aren't they, actually, even in glory. He carries the marks of his suffering with him in eternity. So there's this kind of mystery about kind of the resurrection body. So he appears in the upper room to the majority of the disciples, and they're locked behind doors for fear of the Jews. They're clearly not expecting what happens. And of course, the one that's not there is Thomas, which is kind of tough on Thomas, but great for us, because kind of it gives us permission to have the questions that we have. And it also elicits from Thomas in the end this amazing statement. You know, he who doubts has this amazing statement of faith when he kneels before Jesus and says, my Lord and my God. It kind of puts the seal on who Jesus is. And if you read Paul, we're told that there are so many other encounters, 500 even at one particular occasion. I don't plan to talk about the evidence for the resurrection tonight. It's one of those kind of popular. I've probably spoken about the evidence for the resurrection more at Easter services than I've ever talked about anything before. And then I discovered in a survey that I've been wasting my time. And you want to know why? We really ought to talk about this in a lot more detail, but there's a fascinating survey done this year by the Evangelical Alliance and the Church of England, kind of asking kind of a significant number of people what their views of Jesus, kind of Christianity, church was. And there were some startling things that kind of came out of it. Something like 60% of people believe that Jesus existed, which is amazing. A similar number believe that he rose from the dead. Now that's fascinating, because we kind of think you've got to kind of prove it. We spend all our time trying to prove it, when actually probably most of the people we're trying to prove it to already believe it. So what's the link in the chain that's missing? The fascinating thing, 60% will say they believe that Jesus existed, but actually a relatively few of that number will believe that he was God. They will believe he was a good teacher. They will believe he was a human being. They will believe he was a prophet, but they won't believe he was God. They will believe he rose from the dead, so they might believe it happened, but they don't necessarily kind of make the connection about what it means if he rose from the dead. And of course, if he rose from the dead, that's the thing that kind of proves that Thomas was right. He really is my Lord and my God. He isn't just a man. It's what kind of corroborates all of Jesus's claims and all of the things that he says, and makes him more than just a good person or a teacher or any other human being. So it's kind of, that's the missing link in the chain in people's thinking. And often we seem to put our effort in other places. So I'm not going to talk about that tonight, having just talked about it. It's really bad when none of this is in my notes, you know. It's so bad. We don't know a whole lot about that 40-day kind of period. When you kind of read what Paul says about it in Corinthians, you kind of think, wow, there was a lot going on there if he appeared to all of these people, because we don't have a number of those accounts, just are not recorded in Scripture for us. But what we do know is kind of what he was about with his disciples. Luke says that he opened their minds so that they could understand the Scriptures. It's fascinating, isn't it? He spent 3 years with them, but actually it took the resurrection for him to be able to open their minds and explain the Scriptures in such a way that they kind of got it. And that kind of fits the picture, doesn't it, as well? Because all the time before, when he talks about the fact that he has to go to Jerusalem and die, kind of they can't get their heads around it, they don't understand it, or they protest that it shouldn't happen. It's only kind of with hindsight that the pieces of the jigsaw fall into place for them. And it seems that season that Jesus spends between his resurrection and his ascension is a season in which he kind of helps them find the right place for each of the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. It's kind of what lays the foundation for their ministry that's going to follow. It's clear that part of this kind of period was spent in Galilee. And that's something that the drama picks up on. It's something that kind of comes out of our reading. That little bit about go and tell his disciples and Peter, that phrase, and Peter, that the drama picks up on, that he's going ahead of you into Galilee. So kind of going to Galilee was what they had been told to do. And that's where this particular resurrection appearance takes place. And it's also recorded in the other Gospels, but not in the same sort of detail. So kind of that's the context of what's happening in the resurrection appearances. They've been in Jerusalem, they've had these upper room experiences, and now they've done what Jesus has told them, and they've gone back to Galilee, and Jesus appears to them by the lake. So what about the context with Peter? What's been happening with Peter? He's the focus of this reading. He's the focus of that drama. And if ever there's an example of what it means to be kind of, you know, showing God's glory through jars of clay, it's Peter. throughout Jesus' ministry, Peter takes center stage. If you were to kind of say, well, you know, who kind of takes the limelight, you know, most after Jesus, I think you'd have to say it's Peter. He's audacious. He's certainly outspoken. Sometimes he opens his mouth and what he has to say is utterly brilliant. It's on the money. He sees things or verbalizes things that others don't see or can't kind of pin down. But then there's the flip side. I'm sure I'm not the only one that has a little bit of sympathy for Peter. Because he's a bit of a motor mouth, really, isn't he? And as I think probably you know, some of us have the spiritual gift of opening our mouths without engaging our brain at all. And kind of that's a gift that is clearly an apostolic anointing. Because Peter had it big time. There's the obvious one when he's kind of, when he's been asked about, you know, who do people say I am? And kind of, well, people say that you could be the prophet Elijah and this and that. And then who do you say I am? And Jesus looks around all the disciples. And the only one that's got the courage to say it is Peter and says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. So on the money. And then the next thing Jesus is trying to tell him that he's going to die. And Peter says, no. And Jesus turns around and says, get behind me, Satan. Kind of, you know, it's like he's gone from bang on to bang off. And that's kind of startling. The one I love is the transfiguration. Does no one else find that funny? Yeah, they're on the mountain. They see Moses and Elijah. There's the glory of God, Shekinah glory. A cloud comes down and Jesus is transfigured in front of them. And they kind of see beyond his humanity. They see something of his glory. And Peter says, we could build some huts for you. I mean, it is about as thick as it gets, isn't it? Really? I mean, it's a bit like groping around. I don't know. It's a bit like groping around. I've got to say something because I'm Peter. So I'll say that. I also wonder if that is not a very human reaction in it too, that we often have when we have a good time with God, that we want to keep it going. This is an amazing experience with God. Let's stay here all the time. Let's move away. Let's not move on. And actually, that's not how it's meant to work. You can't bottle experiences with God and live off of them. You have them to enable you to go on to the next thing. And frequently it's the valley that follows the mountaintop. And it's discomfort that follows the good things. So I got a lot of sympathy for Peter. I can see a lot of myself in him. I can also see a lot of myself in kind of the stuff that's being worked through, kind of in this encounter by the lake. Kind of what leads up to it is the night of Jesus's betrayal. Peter with the other disciples is forced to look inward at their own hearts. You know, there's this excruciatingly painful kind of thing that happens around the table when Jesus says to them, one of you is going to betray me. And they're all looking at each other and saying, not me, you're joking. And no, it's not Peter that's going to betray Jesus. But again, he's outspoken. And although he's not going to betray him, Jesus tells him that actually he's going to deny him. And he's going to do it not once, but three times. And he's going to do it before the night has finished, before the cock crows in the morning. And I find that quite interesting. I found my mind going back to it kind of as we were worshipping. And I just found Peter, even in that, quite interesting. Peter has declared, even if all fall away, I will not. Then Jesus says, I tell you the truth. Today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows, you yourself would disown me three times. But Peter insisted emphatically, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. And all the others said the same thing. There's a bit of a caveat there, isn't there? Actually, we kind of get hard on Peter, but they're all saying the same thing. But I just find the way that he protests so kind of vehemently. No, I'm not going to. And I don't know if this is a bloke thing or not. I'm sure you ladies don't do it. I'm sure it's just a bloke thing. If I'm in the wrong, and I know I'm in the wrong, I've said this before, I know, I protest very loudly that I must be right. Now, I'm sure ladies don't do that, but kind of the worst thing that can happen at home is when Carol has asked me to do something and I've not done it, is for her to keep asking me. Because actually, the more I know I'm in the wrong, the more I'm going to protest. And I just wonder if there's a little bit about that going on with Peter. He, you know, they've been confronted with their own weakness, and it's almost like he's trying to convince himself, not just Jesus, that that weakness isn't there. And so it happens that on that night, Peter follows Jesus and the people that have arrested him into the high priest's courtyard. It's amazing. Of all the buildings that are left in Jerusalem, one of the few that kind of dates back from that time is believed to be what would have been the high priest's house. Kind of a lot of it sits below the current ground level. Kind of what would have been the cells still exist downstairs in the house. And the pathway that leads across the Kidron Valley to the Mount of Olives on the other side is still there where they would have walked Jesus on that night. And so they would have taken Jesus on the Mount of Olives. They would have come down the mountain, and then they would have come across the Kidron Valley and all the way up. And then you'd have had to work your way into the courtyard of what would have been actually quite a secure building. Kind of it functioned as a prison as well. And that's where Peter follows Jesus. And it, you know, kind of we're hard on Peter, but he's the only one that's actually had the courage to do that. And yet while he's there, it all unravels and it all goes wrong and Peter's weakness is revealed. So three times he's asked, were you with them? And even kind of a servant girl is enough to send Peter into a spin. And so in the end, he does just what Jesus said he would. He denies him three times, and the cock crows. Sorry, mouth and brain and gear. And, yeah. So first, a little bit about that failure. I think Peter is overconfident. You know, that whole protestation, I will never betray you. And I just think that serves as kind of a warning to all of us that actually none of us know how we will behave in particular circumstances. Peter's intentions are good, but ultimately they're flawed. He's entered the courtyard to help, but actually in the end his weakness is shown up. And ultimately he does deny Jesus. I suspect actually we don't have to be in a courtyard. We don't have to be kind of stirred up in that sort of way to deny Jesus. We can shrink away from conversations when faith comes up, when Jesus comes up. It doesn't just have to be about our words or our lack of them. Sometimes it can be about our actions. We can make kind of claims about living for Jesus and following Jesus. And we can find ourselves doing things that kind of are in complete conflict of that. And that's why kind of Peter is so helpful to us, because in Peter, kind of we see a mirror of our own weaknesses and our own potential to let Jesus down. And we can also see what happens when we do that. Kind of it highlights kind of the dangers that we can kind of face. And I think it reminds us that we need a healthy realism about ourselves, about our strengths and about our weaknesses. We're never meant to serve God in our own strength. It's kind of funny. In only one of the resurrection accounts do you kind of get the Great Commission coming in the upper room. It's in John's Gospel when Jesus says, "As my Father sent me, so I'm sending you." And then he breathes on them and says, "Receive the Holy Spirit." Whilst the Holy Spirit isn't poured out to Pentecost, the point is there. We're not meant to do this on our own. We need the strength of God to do it. It's not about us, but it's about him working through us. And God's glory is displayed, not because of our strength, but because actually through our weakness, others see his glory. I really need to learn to put bookmarks in for everything I want, not just the ones. And in a way, that's what sums up what this talk is all about tonight. Paul writes in Corinthians, "For God said, 'Let light shine out of darkness.' And he made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ." Is the microphone just... Oh, thank you, it's come back. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. And actually, kind of, this kind of event in Peter's life is all about Peter discovering the limitations of his own strength and his need for God's strength. We all mess up, and there's nothing like failure and a sense of failure to cripple us. Often, kind of, it gets associated with shame. When we fail, and we repeatedly fail, kind of shame creeps in, and we want to kind of recoil from Jesus. And we see something of that in that kind of encounter with Peter by the lake. One minute he's rushing towards Jesus, diving off of the boat and swimming ashore. And the next minute, there's this uncomfortable thing when Jesus starts to speak in his life, when he doesn't like what Jesus is saying, and he wants to pull away from it. We all mess up, and there's nothing like failure to cripple us. And I think the attitude in the video often sums it up. When we fail, there's a tendency for us to want to make it right ourselves. I kind of love that line when kind of Jesus eventually nailed Peter, and Peter said, "No, I've got to spend the rest of my life trying to put it right." And often kind of when we mess up, we kind of feel like we can't go back to God until we've got it right. And that's about trying to do it in our own strength. It's shame that forces us to do it. We think we've somehow got to make it right. But actually, of course, what we do is we get further and further away from God. We don't rely on his power. We rely on our own strength, which is frequently weakness. And it just becomes a downward spiral. The grace of God isn't just that Jesus has done enough, but Jesus doesn't let Peter stay in that place. He pulls him back. Peter, it seems to me, is in the business of running away. And that's something we also have a tendency to do when we mess up. I said it was that it was Jesus' idea to go to Galilee. It was never Jesus' idea to go fishing. They get there, and in chapter 41, verse 3, Peter says, well, I'm going to go fishing. And kind of the others all kind of train along behind. When things go wrong, when we kind of think we've messed up, the temptation is all the greater to go back to our old life and to go back to doing the things we did before Jesus was in our lives. I think you see a little bit of it in the parable of the Good Samaritan, of the prodigal son. Let's get the parables right. When the prodigal kind of doesn't think he can go back and be a son, but thinks he'd be better off in his father's house as a servant. I'll just go and kind of and work and help out and go back to what I used to do, but not to the relationship. So what about Jesus's solution? Well, it begins with the catch of fish. We have, if you don't come in the morning very often, you won't realise that on Family Service we have this fascinating game, which it seems to me has been created by John and Claire with one thing in mind, and one thing in mind only, and that is to find a way of embarrassing the vicar. We play this game called Poundonaire, kind of based on Millionaire, you know, and you know how you have the questions and the lifelines, you know, 50-50, you know, it's not ask a friend, is ask the vicar. And they, if they can't answer it, they then get to ask the vicar in front of the whole congregation a biblical question. So far, somehow, by the skin of my teeth, I've managed to answer all of them correctly. It's also a testament to the fact that I'm sure you're wanting to embarrass me in front of the whole congregation. But... but never mind. This morning's question was, how many fish did they catch? And I was 83, 153, 5,000. I can't remember what the other one was. 10. God damn. Very good. How many was it? 153. You were listening. It's very impressive, wasn't it? We did the questions. You ought to know the answer. however many it was, what we're told is it was, you know, it... they hadn't caught anything all night. The nets go down. It's breaking the nets. And it's a catch of fish that is miraculous. What God is doing, what Jesus is doing, is taking Peter back, not to his old life, but back to when he first called him. He's reminded of how when they were first called to leave their nets and to follow him, there was that same miraculous catch of fish. He's taking him back to where it began as he recommissions him and says, I'm still calling you. Peter wants to go back to his old life. Jesus wants to remind him of how his new life began. And it's a physical event, but it's a spiritual picture, because it isn't just about his old life. It's also a picture of what the new life is meant to be like. This is a very dangerous thing to say. I am not saying that God is an American, but it's always better, it's always bigger with God. And that's a very American way of saying something, isn't it, and doing something. But actually, kind of, this catch of fish, the enormity of it is beyond what they would experience. The nets are going to break. They struggle to land it. It's almost sinking the boat. And just the enormity of that harvest is a picture of kind of the reality of what the future has for him, the enormity of what God has for him. And then there come these questions. Do you love me? Not once, not twice, but three times. And I know that there's a difference in the Greek between the different kind of phrases. I'm not going to go into that. On its own, it's just the most challenging question. Do you love me? Do you love me more than these? Now, that's interesting too. Because there's some kind of debate about actually these what? Do you love me more than these other disciples? Well, that's a kind of a strange thing to say. Or do you love me? Kind of, you know, they're standing by the fire where they've eaten the fish. The bones of the food that they've just shared in front of them. Do you love me more than these? And I think Jesus is saying to him, do you love me more than your old life? The old life that you wanted to run back to. Do you love me more than that? And there's some lessons in this. Because this is excruciatingly painful for Peter to be asked, not just once, not just twice, but three times, whether he loves Jesus. And it seems to me that kind of at times we kind of want to pay lip service to things and kind of move on. And actually Jesus isn't allowing Peter to pay lip service to it. He's confronting him with his failure in its entirety. And actually there's you know, the most powerful way to deal with failure is to look it full in the face and not to be in denial about it. We might want to pretend it didn't happen. Jesus won't allow that. And part of the secret to overcoming failure is to confront it and not to ignore it. The more we ignore it, the more we kind of think somehow we'll do better next time, the more likelihood there is that we will fail again next time. And then out of all of this, Peter is recommissioned. This has to be the most uncomfortable call to ministry anyone's ever been given. Because Peter isn't just called by Jesus. Jesus also speaks to him of what that's going to mean. You know, he speaks to him about his death, how people will lead him where he doesn't want to go, that one day there will come a time when he will pay the ultimate price for following Jesus. And kind of people have always talked about the cost of discipleship being high. That can kind of feel like a bit of an academic thing, can't it? We talk about people taking up their cross. It becomes a turn of phrase, not something that we consider as a possible reality. And yet, for Christians around the world today, for many, choosing to follow Jesus actually makes what Peter experienced potentially a reality for them. And Jesus doesn't dress it up for him. It's going to cost everything. It's going to cost everything, but also it's going to mean everything. A little bit, again, like the prodigal son, who wants to go back to the lesser role. He's no more fit to be the son. He's going to be a servant in his father's house and do the menial stuff. Despite Peter's failures, despite his brokenness, despite his denial, Jesus still has a purpose to fulfill through Peter's life. And we can kind of look at our own lives. We can look at our own kind of faith story. And we can see it at times every reason why kind of God shouldn't use us. And the reason for that is that kind of we are confronted with our own weaknesses every time we look in a mirror. Other people will kind of see us and think, John's a nice bloke, isn't he? I'm sure if you ask Claire, you'll discover that. No, sorry, I wouldn't do that to you. I would. But actually, it's not even our wives or the people we share our lives with that know us best. We know ourselves best. And we see our own weaknesses. And we see all the reasons why we should, like the prodigal, go back to being a servant, or like Peter in that drama, which kind of puts a few words on his lips that don't appear in the scriptures, but I think gets the feel of it. You know, I'll spend the rest of my life trying to make it right, when actually Jesus won't give Peter a lesser role. Again and again, he says, feed my sheep. That great shepherd of the flock chooses to share his ministry with Peter. Chooses to share his ministry with us, despite our brokenness, our fallenness, our potential for getting it wrong. He still wants to use us. He wants to put his glory in our lives, so it shines through the frailty of our humanity. Let's pray.